subject today is the recent pastoral letter of the Roman Catholic bishops in the United States. It's entitled The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise and Our Response. And I've put on the board the address where it can be, where you can write for it. It will now be available, I'm sure, as well, rather widely, if you have access to especially Roman Catholic bookstores, but in others as well, perhaps. That address, their origins, it's the name of a documentary service, 1312 Massachusetts Avenue, Washington, D.C., 2005. If you order it from them, it's $3.50, but I think that very soon, if it isn't already the case, the Roman Catholic Church will have it available for something less than that. It is a pastoral letter. That means the bishops see themselves as teachers. That is the primary function of bishop in the New Testament, as teachers who are also moral and spiritual guides. And I read from the conclusion. Why do we address these matters fraught with such complexity, controversy, and passion? We speak as pastors, not politicians. We are teachers, not technicians. We cannot avoid our responsibility to lift up the moral dimensions of the choices before our world and nation. The nuclear age is an era of moral as well as physical danger. We are the first generation since Genesis with the power to virtually destroy God's creation. We cannot remain silent in the face of such danger. Why do we address these issues? We are simply trying to live up to the call of Jesus to be peacemakers in our own time and situation. So it is a pastoral letter, a letter that offers teaching for moral guidance and to remind Christians of their vocation as peacemakers. Now, it is a non-binding document. That's a technical term, and let me explain it. It certainly carries much de facto weight. That is, this will be the subject in every diocese in the nation, in the Roman Catholic Church. Educational materials are being developed to study the letter and to work up curricula from the letter. It is the basis for official actions of the Roman Catholic Church, such as their representatives in Washington. But it is non-binding. That means that you can be a good Catholic and have another position than the bishops. Now, that isn't always the case on everything that the bishops say. I mean, on contraception, it's a different matter. You can't hold a different position and be regarded as a good Catholic. But in this case, you can differ markedly with the bishops and still be a Roman Catholic in good standing. That's what non-binding means. What is the occasion for this letter? I see Dan sitting back there, and I forgot to get to Dan in time. He has a larger version of this chart, which was printed in Christianity in Crisis, and which has become widely used in education doing peace studies. This chart is a chart of the nuclear world. Even from where you're sitting, I hope you can see the square in the middle of the chart with the single dot in it. That single dot represents the explosive power of all of the weapons detonated during World War II. Now, each of the dots on that chart represents the equivalent of all of the explosive power detonated during World War II. And those dots represent the destructive power that's sitting around the world while we're sitting here. That is to say, you're talking about the 6,000 World War IIs in terms of megatons of firepower. In the 6 years of the Second World War, 50 million people were killed. That dot. And then you're looking at the destructive power that's sitting around the world today in terms of just nuclear weapons. The dots encircle up, and you can't see this probably very clearly, in the left, upper left-hand corner, there's a circle that encompasses three dots. That stands for 9 megatons of firepower, which are deployed by a single Poseidon submarine, not our biggest. The United States has 31 Poseidons. So one Poseidon submarine is about three times, in terms of firepower, all of the firepower used in World War II. And we've got 31 of those. If you took a, well, let's look at the other one. Down here in the lower right, there's a circle that covers part of one tile or one square. It encompasses 9 of the dots, 9 World War IIs. So a single Trident submarine, such as we've got 100 and some miles here to the west of us, carries weapons with 24 megatons of firepower, that is 8 World War IIs, enough to destroy every major city in the whole northern hemisphere. If you took a dime and placed on this chart, it would represent enough nuclear weapons to destroy all of the major and medium-sized cities of the world. Now, why do I bring this to our attention? Because the occasion for the Roman Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter is the failure of arms control. The occasion is the failure of restraining the arms race, and then that's just a different way of saying the increase of the chances of nuclear holocaust. Let me explain something about the process of the letter itself. A committee of the bishops produced drafts, three of them, after extensive hearings with experts whose judgments ran along a wide spectrum of points of view and competencies. This hearings process extended over a rather long period of time, about 18 months. The makeup of the committee, the Catholic Bishops Committee, is as follows. Cardinal Joseph Bernardin served as the chairman. Bishop George Fulcher of Lafayette, Indiana was a member. Auxiliary Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit. Auxiliary Bishop John O'Connor of the Military Ordinariate. And Bishop Daniel Riley of Norwich, Connecticut. Those names may not mean much to you, but what's significant in that committee is that they themselves represent a range of points of view within the bishops' conference. For example, Thomas Gumbleton is a member of Pax Christi. Pax Christi is a Roman Catholic pacifist organization to which about roughly a third of the bishops belong. On the other end of the spectrum, John O'Connor is the chief of chaplains, head of the military ordinariate for the Roman Catholic bishops, so very close to the military and the perspectives represented by that. So, and they were chosen because the bishops knew they represented diverse points of view. The staff person is Brian Hare, and I mention that name because he's a person of unusual competency, being both an expert in arms policy in the United States, having done a doctorate in that at Harvard University, and one of the outstanding Roman Catholic ethicists. There were three drafts, two of them in 1982 and the third one in April of this year. And in May of this year, all the bishops voted on the third draft. The document was changed each time, and it was changed in response to both continuation of hearings with experts from all points of view and in response to responses from all manner of folks after each document was published and sent out. And the bishops voted in May and adopted this present document by an overwhelming majority, 238-9. Between the drafts, there was wide public circulation in Roman Catholic and other church circles and in public policy circles. So the drafts were sent to the White House, to universities, etc., and people asked for a response. There were, as I mentioned, significant changes. Oftentimes it was by way of addition. This document now constitutes 32 pages. I don't know when the last time was you wrote a 32-page letter, but they ended up writing one that long, even though it started it was a smaller draft in the beginning. The process itself of these extensive hearings put to rest an initial suspicion that was widely held. I'll read you the gist of that suspicion. It showed up, among other places, in the Washington Post in a column by Edwin Yoder entitled, "What Do Bishops Know of Bombs?" Question mark. And Edwin Yoder, who's a very good writer, said that the opinion of bishops on the fine points of nuclear deterrence is approximately as valuable as the opinion of generals on the fine points of transubstantiation. A medieval debate about the presence of the body and blood of Christ in the bread and the wine. That was the initial suspicion. After the document appeared and was sent out, that opinion was laid to rest, and you had responses to it, such as the following. This is by Stanley Hoffman in the Boston Globe. It's entitled, "Bishops Grasp Complex Issues." Stanley Hoffman is one of the leading experts in the United States on arms issues. And he says this about the third draft now. "The draft shows a highly expert awareness of the complexity of nuclear issues, of the delicate relations between deterrence, the threat and capability to resort to nuclear weapons in case of enemy attack, and the actual willingness to use nuclear weapons should deterrence fail. Highly expert awareness of the difficult doctrines of nuclear war aimed either at cities or at military targets. Expert awareness of the distinction between nuclear, general and limited nuclear war, of the crucial distinctions between the deterrence of nuclear attack and extended deterrence. In other words, deterring through nuclear means a conventional attack on one's enemies." And then Hoffman goes on to talk about the document and other aspects. But the point is that the bishops, through this hearings process, did in fact show their grasp of the technical issues. I might add parenthetically that that is often precisely where church statements fail. We generally do not have a sufficient grasp of highly technical aspects of important issues. The mail and the comment from the community of experts was one of acknowledgement of that. There was disagreement sometimes by the expert, but those disagreements with the bishops were on matters of judgment and conclusions drawn from it, and not disagreements on whether or not the bishops had understood U.S. strategic policy, for example. Well that the generals would do so well on matters, on the fine points of transubstantiation. Now, the letter has gotten rather widespread acknowledgement as a significant piece. I read to you an item from this summer. Bishops speak, United Nations listens. The Disarmament Times roving reporter took to the halls during this year's Disarmament Commission session, asking in the corridors the question, what do you think will be the impact of the United States Catholic Bishops' pastoral letter on war and peace? Nobody said, what letter? Responses ranged from astounding to, I'm sorry, I cannot comment on a domestic U.S. matter. For the latter reason, all comments were made off the record and are identified only by region. One diplomat declared the letter was more important than all 59 resolutions of the last General Assembly. But at least nobody said, what letter? So we've gotten a response to the letter, and again, much more than any other church document in recent times in the United States. I'm going to read just one of the responses and use it at the same time as a way of highlighting the significance of the letter. The response is by a non-Roman Catholic, John Bennett. John Bennett is a well-known Protestant theologian and ethicist, and this response is in the magazine Christianity and Crisis. It will take me a little bit of time to read it, but again, I do so because it's also a way of picking up the content of the letter as well as showing you a response from the non-Catholic community. Our perceptions concerning the religious and moral meaning of nuclear weapons and nuclear war can never be the same again. The core of what the Roman Catholic bishops have said in their pastoral letter is that nuclear weapons should never be used in the ways in which governments are preparing to use them. Many of us have known this in our hearts, but we have refrained from saying so because we did not want to undercut deterrence. I have said it only once in this journal, and I half apologize for doing so because I did not want to make deterrence less credible. We'll talk in a bit about the meaning of deterrence here. Today, there is less confidence than formerly that the structure of nuclear deterrence will prevent nuclear war. And there is awareness that our government is building up nuclear armaments not only to deter, but also to fight a war. The bishops have unusual visibility, and their initial influence will be great because of their own vast constituency. They can persuade people outside that constituency because they did not issue an ecclesiastical edict, which would depend for its authority on their role as bishops. We'll see in the letter itself how they move into a conversation that assumes that can proceed quite apart from whether one even holds Christian faith as a starting point. They came to their positions by a process that non-Catholics, both religious and secular, can appreciate. It included three drafts, open discussion, listening to people from all sides, and final debate among themselves that the public could hear. They did not merely respond to the higher authority of the Pope, but went beyond what he has said, but perhaps not beyond his spirit. They differ from bishops in some other countries because they speak as citizens of one of the two superpowers that have vast nuclear armaments and may be tempted to use them. They draw out the implications of traditional teachings about the just war, which Roman Catholics have most fully developed, but which many others share, by reasoning that people of many traditions can follow, to show that a nuclear war could not meet the criteria of a just war. Their influence is the greater because no one can even raise the question of their being influenced by propaganda or pressure from the Soviet Union. Already there have been statements from persons of religious faith from other traditions that indicate there is readiness to accept what is basic in the bishop's letter. Last November, the Council of Methodist Bishops sent a telegram to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops expressing thanks to God for your courageous witness on behalf of peace and justice. It is more remarkable that the American Academy of Religion, which includes many hundreds of theologians of various traditions and which is not an advocacy organization, declared at its annual meeting last December, quote, "We wish to state publicly our conviction that the use of nuclear weapons under any circumstances is contrary to the faith and the fundamental moral values of the religious traditions of humankind," end of quote. Immense and baffling problems of statecraft remain, and they will not be immediately affected by the movement of thought stimulated by the bishop's letter. But that gives people in the churches no excuse to continue to tell one another and the nation that it may be within religious and moral bounds, even in retaliation, to devastate another nation with nuclear bombs, either by attacks on cities or by attacks on military targets, the side effects of which would mean the destruction of many millions of people and serious damage even to the global environment. Sometimes the inference is drawn from the tradition of Christian realism with which this journal has been associated that nothing really new can be expected in the behavior of nations. Something new has happened. Never before has humanity been threatened by self-destruction that may be irreversible. Always before, it was expected that new generations could have fresh starts, and always before, it was possible to find relief from the worst destructions by seeking another place. This radical change of circumstances requires from nations a new response. Okay, that's one response of appreciation and highlighting the significance of the letter. Now, I've put on the board an outline of the letter. Let me read it to you. The letter is divided into four sections. First, a theology of peacemaking, the kind of thing that we did in more abbreviated form the first session in this series. Basic biblical and theological perspectives that shape one's way of approaching the issues. Now, what issues? Well, that's the second part of the letter. War and peace in the modern world. And that's where the bishops investigate the arms policy and the strategic policy of the United States, of the Soviet Union, and draw some conclusions after investigating those policies. And then there's a third section entitled The Promotion of Peace, Constructive Responses. It isn't enough to criticize the current state of affairs if one doesn't go on to offer some concrete suggestions of better ways to go. And that's what the third section of the letter is about. And the fourth section is a pastoral challenge to Roman Catholics in particular. So in the last section, they talk about the meaning of what has been discussed heretofore for the church as a whole, for educational programs, for different groups, educators, parents, youth, scientists, men and women in military service, men and women of science, men and women in defense industries, men and women in the media, etc. So offering again what they hoped is sound moral guidance. Let me just read a paragraph from the conclusion as a way of kind of summarizing the statement, and then we'll get into some of its details. What are we saying? Fundamentally, we are saying that the decisions about nuclear weapons are among the most pressing moral questions of our age. While these decisions have obvious military and political aspects, they involve fundamental moral choices. In simple terms, we are saying that good ends defending one's country, protecting freedom, etc., cannot justify immoral means, the use of weapons which kill indiscriminately and threaten whole societies. We fear that our world and nation are headed in the wrong direction. More weapons with greater destructive potential are produced every day. More and more nations are seeking to become nuclear powers. In our quest for more and more security, we fear we are actually becoming less and less secure. In the words of our Holy Father, we need a moral about face. The whole world must summon the moral courage and technical means to say no to nuclear conflict, no to weapons of mass destruction, no to an arms race which robs the poor and the vulnerable, and no to the moral danger of a nuclear age which places before humankind indefensible choices of constant terror or surrender. Peacemaking is not an optional commitment, it is a requirement of faith. We are called to be peacemakers not by some movement of the moment, but by our Lord Jesus. The content and context of our peacemaking is not set by some political agenda or ideological program, but by the teaching of the Church. Okay, now let's get into the letter a bit. It's not one one can easily summarize. You almost would end up reading it. So I have decided that in order to allow some time for discussion and yet get into portions of the letter, I'll just concentrate on sections, on the second section, War and Peace in the Modern World, and the third section, Some Constructive Proposals for Peace. We did the first, in the first part of the letter, we did in a different form in the first session, and the discussion yesterday of just war and pacifism as Christian responses also is covered in the first part and part of the second. Some comments on the background to the second section. When the second draft was made public, it caused a real stir in the Reagan administration and the media in general, because it came out in opposition to U.S. Policy, which is a policy of deterrence, that is, the possessing nuclear weapons in order to deter the Soviet Union or any other nuclear power from using theirs against us. Deterrence policy, and then we have to tick off, and we can do that in a minute, particular strategies associated with that. And William Clark, the assistant to the president, wrote a letter of disagreement with the Roman Catholic bishop's stand. He had been one of the people who had testified before the bishops, along with Caspar Weinberger and high-level officials in the Pentagon. That letter was published in the New York Times, among other places. It was interesting to me in talking with the chief drafter of this letter, Brian Heer, that most people assumed that the chief concern of the bishops then for the third draft would be their response to the Reagan administration's discomfort with it. But it wasn't their chief concern. After they finished receiving the responses to the second draft, there were listed for their continuing work four major items or areas. Their first concern between the second and third draft was to address the internal moral argument. That is, Catholics have traditions of arguing about the moral dimensions of any issues. And the second draft included two different traditions. One tradition argues that you can decide whether something is moral or immoral on the basis of the intention involved. And since Let me back up. Let me just list these first, and then I'll come back to each. The internal moral argument was the chief problem to be looked at, because there are two traditions, and they're not at ease with one another in the second draft. The second problem that had to be addressed was the fact that other bishops around the world had probably would have other views. The West German bishops, the English bishops, and the Italian bishops would probably be more in favor of a deterrence policy than the American bishops would be. That the church there is more conservative on these issues. The third problem was the Pope. The Pope had come out in a speech before the United Nations giving his endorsement to a limited deterrence policy, and the American bishops were tending to be to the left of the Pope. Now, it's a problem when bishops don't agree with the Pope. And so that was the third problem. And the fourth problem, and these are orders of priority, the fourth problem was a response to the Reagan administration. I mention that because I find it rather fascinating. What you see happening here is that the Roman Catholic Church, because it is a genuinely global church, has to take account of the points of view of its members around the world, and that has a higher place in its determining of its policy locally than does the nation in which that local segment of the church resides. I mean, here, what you see here is the functioning in practical terms of global institution. So the other bishops and the Pope were more important in terms of issues to respond, matters of response, than was the Reagan administration. Now, there's another reason why the response to the Reagan administration came up last in terms of importance, although it had to be addressed. And that is that the Roman Catholic bishops were very sure of their own stance in just war theory. We talked yesterday about the elements of just war, the criteria of just war policy. This document says that nuclear strategy, as it is formulated by the U.S. and the USSR, violates the criteria of discrimination, that is, some segments are to be immune, the innocent are to be immune from the consequences of warfare as much as possible, and there are ways of stipulating that, and the other criterion is proportionality. The good that is to be expected from the prosecution of the war must exceed the destruction involved in attaining it. You don't destroy something in order to save it. They were very sure, after they talked to all the experts about how nuclear warfare would be conducted if deterrence failed, that they were sure where they were in just war theory. They were also sure of U.S. policy out of their hearings, their grasp of the technical detail. And all they had to do was put the two together. When they did that, they knew where they stood with respect to the Reagan administration. It's not simply the Reagan administration. It's the Reagan administration now, but you would have said the same thing about the previous administration. Let me cite the heart of that. They're addressing four questions here in the middle of this section on war and peace in the modern world. The four are the use of nuclear weapons, the policy of deterrence in principle and in practice, specific steps to reduce the danger of war, and long-term measures of policy and diplomacy. And on the first one, the use of nuclear weapons, they have this to say. Establishing moral guidelines in the nuclear debate means addressing first the question of the use of nuclear weapons. That question has several dimensions. It is clear that those in the church who interpret the gospel teaching as forbidding all use of violence would oppose any use of nuclear weapons under any circumstances. In a sense, the existence of these weapons simply confirms and reinforces one of the initial insights of the nonviolent position, that is, a Christian pacifist. Namely, that Christians should not use lethal force, since the hope of using it selectively and restrictively is so often an illusion. Nuclear weapons seem to prove this point in a way heretofore unknown. For the tradition, now going on to just war, which acknowledges some legitimate use of force, some important elements of contemporary nuclear strategies move beyond the limits of moral justification. A justifiable use of force must be both discriminatory and proportionate. Certain aspects of both U.S. and Soviet strategies fail both tests, as we will discuss below. The technical literature and the personal testimony of public officials who have been closely associated with U.S. nuclear strategy have both convinced us of the overwhelming probability that major nuclear exchange would have no limits. On the more complicated issue of limited nuclear war, we are aware of the extensive literature and discussion which this topic has generated, and they cite it. As a general statement, it seems to us that public officials would be unable to refute the following conclusion of the study made by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. Quote, even a nuclear attack directed only at military facilities would be devastating to the country as a whole. And then they go on to lay out how the Soviets have 40 major installations within the city limits of Moscow alone, and there are 40,000 military installations targeted by the U.S. in the Soviet Union, and likewise the reverse. So that's why they're saying, even though you're only talking about directly attacking military facilities, the devastation would be very widespread. This is because military facilities are widespread rather than concentrated at only a few points. Thus, many nuclear weapons would be exploded. Furthermore, the spread of radiation due to the natural winds and atmospheric mixing would kill vast numbers of people and contaminate large areas. The medical facilities of any nation would be inadequate to care for the survivors. An objective examination of the medical situation that would follow a nuclear war leads to but one conclusion. Prevention is our only recourse. Now, we're not going to take the time here, but I want to point it out that the letter does take up different strategies that have been formulated for deterrence and for the prosecution of nuclear warfare if deterrence should fail. And then the letter judges each of those. Counterpopulation warfare is one of them. Can I put them up there? The initiation of nuclear war and limited nuclear war. And then it goes and talks about the moral principles for deciding on each of them and then draws its own conclusions. Okay, so that we have a chance at least for some discussion, I'll finish here by saying that we neglect the letter if you only do what in fact I have done, namely focus on Area 2. The media did that because that's where the rub came with the Reagan administration. And so that's what we heard about, if we heard anything about that. But the letter goes on in Section 3 to make constructive proposals for peace. And again, it gets rather detailed. I invite you to read those sections. Accelerated work for arms control, reduction, and disarmament with some proposals. Continued insistence on efforts to minimize the risk of war, how one might go about that. The relationship of nuclear and conventional or non-nuclear defenses. Civil defense, efforts to develop nonviolent means of conflict resolution, some discussion of some possibilities there, the role of conscience, education, formation of character over the long haul, and then a section on shaping a peaceful world, which talks about world order, and the fact of interdependence and what it means, a section entitled The Superpowers in a Disordered World, that is a section talking about especially the relationship of the U.S. and the USSR, what ought to be pursued there, interdependence from fact to policy, those are the general topic headings in that section, and then the last part, as I mentioned, is the pastoral challenge to specific groups and specific jobs. Okay, let me just open it up, and if you want to pick up on some elements of these sections, we can do that. Or questions on other things.
Yeah. What has been the feeling of the consistency from the local congregations? Has there been any feeling how the people themselves?
I don't know what response there has been, partly because I've been gone from Washington, D.C. now 3 months and have been kind of out of touch with what the response is to the National Catholic Conference. I do know that there have been events planned in the diocese to study the letter, day-long events with speakers and groups assigned to study it, but I don't really know what the reception has been. We had a forum earlier in the year when we had a Roman Catholic priest and members of his congregation come to Holden, and that's from Seattle area, was it? I think. Anyway, he made the interesting comment that what had helped get some attention in the local area was the fact that Archbishop Hunthausen had spoken to the LCA convention and called for citizens of the state of Washington to withhold some of their tax monies in protest. And the consequence of that was that they were paying some attention to Hunthausen. But now that's a local matter, just as Matheson in Texas, and doesn't really tell you about a widespread response. He also, the Roman Catholic priest also said the fact that Lutherans and others were giving attention to the pastoral letter, a Presbyterian congregation that was neighbor to them, etc., made them think that they, the Catholics, better read it as well. He said the usual response to a bishop's letter is one of benign neglect, that there really isn't usually much interest in what the bishops have to say. But this one had elicited a different response. Now, I can't tell you beyond that. Maybe some others can.
What is the state of the notion of deterrence after this?
You mean in the letter?
A Catholic who reads the letter, is moved by the letter, how would the good Catholic respond to the notion of deterrence? Is that a credible notion?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the letter does not rule out the policy of deterrence. And again, a reminder that deterrence means the possession of nuclear weapons with the hope that that means deterring the use of them by anybody. Which eventually became the basis for the United States-Soviet partial test ban treaty, and subsequently both superpowers removed 10,000 troops from Central Europe, and each of them announced a cut in production of nuclear material for weapons. Now, the Roman Catholic bishops are advocating them, and the letter comes out with a highly qualified support of a strategy of limited deterrence. This letter does not call for unilateral disarmament. It says, we affirm a policy of limited deterrence. Limited means that you have sufficient weapons, nuclear weapons, to deter another nation or other nations from the temptation to use them. But it is sufficiency, as they say, that is just enough to deter them, rather than a quest for superiority in weapon and firepower. So they go on to say deterrence is then the starting point for reduction. And they recommend that the United States take some limited initiatives, even unilaterally, to reduce arms. Here they're agreeing with a wide number of other people like George Kennan, Richard Barnett, and others who have been advisors on arms policies or have been diplomats in negotiations. And then they cite historical evidence where that's worked. You know, Kennedy, President Kennedy, made the move in his administration. He announced that the United States would unilaterally forego further nuclear tests. And the next month, Khrushchev proposed a limited test ban, which eventually became the basis for the United States-Soviet partial test ban treaty. And subsequently, both superpowers removed 10,000 troops from Central Europe, and each of them announced a cut in production of nuclear material for weapons. Now, the Roman Catholic bishops are advocating then that the United States take, well, they are also asking the Soviet Union to do it, but the United States take unilateral initiatives, not disarmament, but initiative, reduction in this process. Now, to answer your question, Dave, I don't know what the response has been by Roman Catholics, but
poses a paradox in the sense that you have this deterrent, but you still be immoral to use it.
Well, that's part of the internal moral argument,
But I think that it still acts as a deterrent because in the event of the nuclear war, the whole concept of a nice morality kind of goes out, or there's a risk.
Yeah.
So let's suppose we had weapon systems and that we believe that they shouldn't be used. And if the Soviet Union were to make an attack, there would be such chaos that whole moral system itself might be destroyed. So there's still a deterrent value. There's still a deterrent value. I mean, you can have a culture say, we've got weapons and we believe it's wrong to use them.
Yeah.
And it still, I think, holds a deterrent value.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe even stronger than we've got weapons and we're willing to use them.
Rudy? Excuse me. Rudy and then Tom.
Although apparently directed to the Catholic membership all over the world, do you think the Catholic bishops also have another kind of a Christian motive to rally support from the world, from Protestant groups and others? Because it seems like the Protestants are dragging their tails on this thing, and they took the initiative.
This earlier once in the summertime, and one of the persons who's a staff member in the Office of Church and Society of the American Lutheran Church heard the tapes and sent me a letter saying, you should have mentioned the ALC mandate on peacemaking, because we said very much the same thing, and the members of the ALC have treated that much like most Roman Catholics treat the bishop's statements. Didn't know that. And in fact, that ALC mandate of peacemaking does say very much the same thing.
But they do the same kind of study. I mean,
no, it isn't. Don't have the grasp of the technical detail. Yeah. But I want to address your question, Rudy. The letter itself says that this is addressed to two groups, the Catholic faithful and the wider civil community. And in fact, in arguing their point of view in the letter, they appeal to a tradition of moral reasoning which any person can follow. It doesn't require that one confess Jesus Christ as Lord, for example, in order to follow this. And that's the just war tradition. Those are kind of common sense criteria to be arrived at by sound secular rationality. And so there is an appeal to engage as wide a discussion as possible, as well as address the Catholic community. Now, it doesn't specify Protestants. They want to talk about everyone, whether of religious or secular persuasion. Tom?
Well, one point on the difference between the ALC statement and the Catholic statement, I do think that their stance on deterrence is a little bit different. The Roman Catholics have come out a little bit stronger in calling, coming close to call, deterrence. I don't know if they use the word simple situation or not in the last draft, but they seem to say that it was wrong and we needed to. And the ALC statement only calls it an ethical dilemma that we must live with.
It does call weapons of mass destruction immoral.
But it calls the possession of them an ethical dilemma that we must live with.
Yeah.
But I guess in response to both the ALC statement and the Catholic bishops, I would, going back to David, I would express my disappointment, I guess, on the deterrence issue, that we continue to, even hesitatingly, so we continue to accept deterrence. And I think in reality, it's an avoidance of our duty as Christians to seek out other alternatives to dealing with conflict in this day and age. And we cling to these nuclear stockpiles because we can't envision any other alternative. And I think it's only when we say no to deterrence that those other alternatives will come alive. And I think that's really the reason that there have been so few Christians that have actively supported the National Peace Academy, so few Christians that know anything about civilian-based, non-military defense, so few Christians that actually study nonviolence, because we haven't said no solidly to deterrence.
Now, in the letter itself, and in anticipating those kinds of that point of view, one must say that the Catholic bishops insist that one explore nonviolent means of conflict resolution. I mean, that is there, and do not want this highly qualified position on limited deterrence to take the edge off a rejection of the presence of nuclear weapons. I mean, they want to get rid of them. Let me just cite a portion here. In the post-conciliar, after Vatican II, meaning, assessment of war and peace and specifically of deterrence, different parties to the political moral debate within the church and in civil society have focused on one or another aspect of the problem. For some, the fact that nuclear weapons have not been used since 1945 means that deterrence has worked, and this fact satisfies the demands of both the political and the moral order, so some people say. Others contest this assessment by highlighting the risk of failure involved in continued reliance on deterrence and pointing out how politically and morally catastrophic even a single failure would be. That is, that it has worked means not a whole lot if it fails, because only one failure is one thing. The risk of failure is too high. Okay, still others note that the absence of nuclear war is not necessarily proof that the policy of deterrence has prevented it. Indeed, some would find in the policy of deterrence the driving force in the superpower arms race, kind of point of view that you or others might well, point you might well make. Still other observers, many of them Catholic moralists, have stressed that deterrence may not morally include the intention of deliberately attacking civilian populations or non-combatants.
And then they go on to say, although we acknowledge the need for deterrence, not all forms of deterrence are morally acceptable. And they outline what in fact are present policies as forms which are not morally acceptable. But I must say, Tom, that they do not want their statement of deterrence to be used as any kind of excuse for doing anything but moving away from the present policy towards what in effect is to be mutual disarmament.
And that's where I have a problem, because I think what's happened with the statement and what people have heard is that there's still room for deterrence, and therefore those other live possibilities aren't live for us, because this deterrence is still a possibility for capitalists.
Yeah, okay, now, I think you're right, because that's what's picked up, but the statement itself does not support that. The statement says the only reason that we can say yes in a highly qualified manner to the policy of deterrence is that we can imagine a situation in which if one side did unilaterally disarm, the other side might be tempted to use their nuclear weapons as the occasion for something which would be more oppressive than the present. That is, they're judging things on the basis of consequences that can be imagined. But that's the only reason. Yeah.
What's the ethical history of that? In other words, it's kind of an ethical twist. If we reduce ours, we may increase the probability that they use theirs, and therefore what is the ethical? Is there any ethical parallel in that? When I do something that's basically good, but it increases the probability that someone else might do something basically bad, it's a complex ethical problem, it sounds to me.
Sure.
Yeah, I know, but is there anything in there that they do with that?
Well, I mentioned earlier that the second draft had argued from two moral traditions, and they were in some tension with one another. One moral tradition is that you argue whether something is morally good or evil on the basis of intention, or whether it's intrinsically right or wrong. So they condemn the possession of nuclear weapons per se on the basis that one cannot use these things. One cannot intend to use them. They are wrong. They saw an intrinsically evil character about weapons of mass destruction. Now, the other tradition is that you argue whether something is right or wrong on the basis of the consequences of their uses. And on the basis of that, they could imagine that the case for a limited deterrent. And that's where we're back to that question of how can you say something is wrong just by their existence, just the possession of nuclear weapons, or in the movie the other night, to build a nuclear weapon is a sin. There's one judgment, and on the other judgment to talk about the consequences of their use. Now this draft finally came out in favor of arguing the prudentialist way, that is, on the basis of probable consequences, rather than saying the sheer existence per se is a matter of of condemning, or as a basis for condemning them. The difficulty was, could the bishops endorse on grounds of consequences a policy, limited deterrence, that they declared wrong on moral grounds of intentionality? And that was the rub in there. And that is the paradox, moral paradox. And then you go into all sorts of moral contortion here, because they ended up saying, okay, we know that to use them would be wrong, and at the same time, does their sheer existence work as a deterrent, even when you said it would be morally wrong to use them?
That's what
I'm
saying. Yeah. Have you seen the film If You Love Us Past?
As we've had it here once this summer.
I've only seen it once, so I don't know whether I really caught it, but Helen Caldicott, in the position of social responsibility, was arguing the point that even if the United States were to get rid of all nuclear weapons unilaterally, then there would be no reason for the Soviet Union to use nuclear weapons on the United States. So at least the world would be saved that destruction. And so, you know, you'd still be alive to fight something as opposed to everybody gone.
Yeah.
And somehow I have to follow, I guess I'm more pacifist than anything else, I have to follow that.
We need to close, but the letter itself has sections in it which address the relationship of nuclear forces and conventional forces, as non-nuclear forces, as well as issues of civil defense, etc. And in its section on constructive proposals, and I just commend that to you. It isn't. I mean, it's one more element in a major debate, but I think one must express appreciation to the bishops for making an intelligent and intelligible document available to the general public and doing what they can to get us all in on this so that it doesn't remain something handled only in chambers we never have access to.
The meeting, World Council of Churches, have any kind of a statement, you know?
Yes. Addressed to the superpowers, U.S. and USSR. I see part of it. It doesn't involve anything this extensive. It is a statement, much briefer, and without the process. It doesn't mean it's any better or worse. Well, I think there's a lot of things happening. I mean, the nuclear freeze movement is an example. That is, you know, most of the Protestant denominations are, if they have not already done so, are in the process of working up materials as well as issuing statements. The Presbyterians have done so. The Reformed Church in America have done so. The Methodists are formulating some things for the next General Conference. It isn't as though nothing is happening.
Plus, they get a chance now to vote on the local level for the freedom.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
How does the pacifist group respond?
Okay. The letter itself, and you must understand, first of all, that the Roman Catholic Church is not a pacifist church, right, even though it's always been, you could be a Roman Catholic in good standing,
right,
as a pacifist. It has always permitted both the pacifist and the just war tradition as credible and even faithful expressions of Christian faith. But the majoritarian point of view is in the Catholic Church has been on the side of the just war. What's significant in this document compared with past Roman Catholic statements is that it says the pacifist tradition must be listened to in a way that it has not been listened to before. It gives more space to it. When it works at constructive proposals for peace, it says we must underscore the need to develop nonviolent means, and maybe I can find it right off the bat, I'm not sure. It just gives it more play.
From the past of this community to this.
Now, sometimes it's been to say, you know, the Catholic bishops have just not gone far enough in the direction of the pacifist community. John Schramm shared yesterday the response of Daniel Berrigan. Would Peter consult or Jesus consult with Pilate about proceedings or not? You know. But Pax Christi, the Roman Catholic organization, even though it would like to have seen more in the way of directions toward disarmament and not the endorsement of limited deterrence policy, has been encouraged by...
Where's Berrigan?
Well, that's what I was just quoting Berrigan. But Gumbleton, of Pax Christi, one of the members of the community, you know, says we've at least got more of a hearing on this than we've gotten on other issues. And the Roman Catholic group, Pax Christi, has had a significant growth in the last few years, as have all groups with what we're often referred to now as a nuclear pacifist position, that is.
I heard Berrigan one time, I thought he said he really didn't, the Peace Academy notion was, he kind of put that down.
I don't.
I got the impression from the Berrigan group, like, look, the issue is so clear, going through all of this kind of intellectualizing is just kind of making groups, and you left open a little door in terms of deterrence, and so we're just, that's just immoral, the whole thing, that's it, there's no question. There seems to be an element that says that.
I'm sure.
I have the response from Pax Christi if you want to look
at it. Oh, do you?
Yeah. Basically what you said, largely supportive it, and on several points they would want them to go farther, but I think they would please.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just one comment. I was in Europe this summer, and our Lutheran brothers and sisters there are very aware of the Catholic bishop's letter and very supportive of it, and we're not aware of what Lutherans had said.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe just because of the press, but they sent us back and encouraged our bishops to say something as strong.
There are some ironies here, though. I mean, the Roman Catholics and Protestants have protested for years about the polity of the Roman Catholic Church, that you have a hierarchical ordering of things. And that is undemocratic, that what you need to do is get as close to the grassroots as you can, and everyone debate something at that level and have it filter up. But when in fact you look at whose positions get some attention, no one has heard what the United Church of Christ has to say on these issues, although you may agree with them in ways that you might not with the Roman Catholic. But when you've got a massive institution organized in hierarchical fashion, and they do decide to do something, it has the means by which to command a whole lot of attention. So.
Yeah, they're really the big boys, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. So that
there seems to
can
be
played a couple of
an
ways.
Academic tradition that I don't see in the Protestant. Really studying, the different traditions and going back, what did St. Thomas say? If you look at it, you get the impression they did their homework, whereas that initial response that one columnist said, look, they don't know anything about it, to a large extent that does fit the Protestant. A lot of the Protestants, things come across as though we wanted to make a nice statement as quick as possible.
Yeah. It's true. The Roman Catholic Church has developed a vast body of social thought. We'll close, but let me just close on this note. The bishops have decided next to do a pastoral letter on the American economic system. And on that one, I can, shouldn't say exactly, I don't know exactly where they'll come out, because it'll be a process like this one of hearings, of drafts, of redrafts, etc., wide public discussion. But there is a vast body of Catholic social thought on economic life which will shape those drafts. And it is a body of thought which comes out very strong on the side of workers and labor, and we'll see what occurs there. Whereas Protestants tend to think that if you've got the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand, you can do ethics. You know, you kind of vacate the tradition and the deep technical detail. The process.
But now that we've kind of decided that these Catholics have done it right, how do you go home to your local congregation that looks at Catholics?
Well,
you know, in our church, it's really interesting that we come this week when everything's cold, because on Thursday, the night before we took off, I had to go to the church and view with my social ministry committee God's metal. Decide whether we were going to use it in the forum. And the first thing that came across, well, but it's made by Catholics. Can we show this? What are we going to do?
I hope that you can, in the case of this document, get past that. By just asking if they would read a portion of it, because it is so non-sectarian. It's addressed to the wider civic community, an appeal on that basis. And also the first section on the theology of peacemaking is a section which doesn't have anything in it that would theologically be at odds with Protestant tradition. I mean, it's essentially the unfolding of a scriptural case for peacemaking as Christian vocation. And that's one of the major changes since the Second Vatican Council. The best biblical scholarship going on in recent years has been done by Roman Catholics. Yeah.
The sure void is in central area, and I think the Catholic Church is moving into that.
Yeah.
More than Protestant.
Well, for obvious reasons, though. I mean, it's overwhelmingly Catholic.
I know.
Yeah. There's also much ecumenical cooperation across some lines, anyway.
This is the other thing, that if you have never lived maybe overseas where you've had to experience, where who is working together? It is the Catholics and the Protestants working together to do justice. And you see that all the barriers fall over in Africa or Latin America.
Yeah.
As the home, you can still. Well, they don't
know. Or the churches are themselves divided. So some Catholics are working with some Protestants, and those Catholics are being opposed by other Catholics, and those Protestants are being opposed by other Protestants. That happens as well.
There is a lot of people out of the church.
Yeah. But I would hope that, you know, we could circulate this as widely as possible, because it is not a narrowly denominational document. On the contrary. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.